That was really well done. That was terrific. I hadn't read that passage because I knew it was going to be read to me. So that's very interesting what's going on there. You know the story of David and Goliath. You have probably known it since Sunday school when you were a kid, if you grew up in the church. And the fact is that it is, for all intents and purposes, a fairy tale. Or, as we would normally call it, a folk tale, but it is not a historical incident. I hate to tell you that right off the bat, but I thought I would let you know. There are a number of reasons why we know this is true. There are actually a whole bunch of reasons. One of them is that the place where it's put in 1 Samuel is following a couple of instances where David and Saul, the king of Israel, King Saul, have met. And yet, when this story begins, in this part of Samuel, it's like they have never met each other. They're meeting for the first time again. So it's a little weird in its placement. Another thing that's interesting is the kind of armor that they wear. This story supposedly takes place in the 900 BCE period. That armor doesn't actually appear in the world until about 400. And so it's actually Greek armor. And that appears in the 300s over in the Middle East. So the armor that they're using is not the way they would have dressed for battle. Archaeologists have figured that out. So that's a problem. There are some other problems too. But another one is that in 2 Samuel 21, there's a verse where somebody else kills Goliath. It says, and this was much harder to read than your whole thing. This is just one line. Elhanan, the son of Jareorgeam, I have no idea what that's pronounced like, the Bethlehemite, struck down Goliath the Gittite. So all of a sudden you find at the end of 2 Samuel a little phrase that indicates somebody else killed Goliath. Now, and Goliath came from a different town. Also, the town of Gath that Goliath actually comes from was not around in the 900s. It was a much later city. So all these things indicate that what you're dealing with here is a folk tale. And the reason it's in the Bible where it is because it's trying to tell you the differences between Saul, the king of Israel, and David. The fact is that David doesn't appear to be king material at all. Saul, on the other hand, is known for one physical characteristic, that he is tall. That's about all that Saul has going for him. He is indecisive. He has a difficult time making a decision. He makes decisions and then doesn't trust Yahweh, the Israelite God, to back him up. And he is generally ineffectual. He's not a decisive man of action. Whereas David comes into this story exactly the opposite. He's not tall. In fact, when they come over to test out who's going to be in the family of Jesse, who's going to be the next king, they immediately go to the oldest brother in the family, David's oldest brother, David's the youngest, and they look at him, and he's tall, well-built, charismatic, and they're very disappointed when it turns out God doesn't want this guy to be the king. Instead, it's a young little kid, David. David is pictured as short, not like Saul at all, who's tall. But more than that, David, as you can see in this story, does all the things the king of Israel is supposed to do. He's decisive, he's creative, he's inventive, he goes after what he wants, he calls upon Yahweh's help when he needs it. He is, in fact, cunning, innovative, and all the things the king Saul isn't. And it's very symbolic when he tries to put on Saul's armor and it doesn't fit, because it truly doesn't fit. Thank goodness for them. Now, what happens in the story is, in fact, how battles often started in the ancient world. The sides would line up across from each other, and at that point, the best warrior from one side would march into the middle of the battlefield and immediately challenge the other side to come forward with one of theirs, and they would trade insults. It's a very macho, testosterone-filled battle scene. And this is how battles often began.
So what you have in the scripture, believe it or not, are two macho guys coming forward and telling each other what they're going to do with each other and how badly they're going to beat up each other. And if you go back over the scripture, you can see it. If it was, I don't need to read it again because it was so well read the first time. But listen to what, you know, the comments. A Philistine says to David, "Come to me and I'll give your flesh to the birds of the air and the animals of the field. You come to me with sword and spear and javelin." And then David answers back, "I'm going to cut off your head and give it to the dead bodies of the Philistine army, to the birds of the air and the animals of the earth." And he kind of one-ups. "I'm not only going to feed your body to the birds, but I'm going to cut your head off first." And they go back and forth, and then they oftentimes have a battle between the two people. And that's exactly what happens here. Now, we always think of this as a very almost childlike thing. He has a slingshot. Slingshots were not toys. There, in fact, were reports of army units which were so skilled in slingshots that they would beat all comers. This was a projectile hurled at a very high rate of speed right at someone. And what happens is, if you're really good at it, it's like firing a stone out of a gun. It comes at that level of velocity. So this is not child's play. This is warfare. You know, Goliath comes out, and by the way, there's some recent people have said that the way they actually measure, he's probably a little over 6 feet. But most people say 9. But it's probably, they lived in a time where everybody's 5 foot. So over six feet was gigantic. Goliath has, we assume, armor on as well. And if it's the kind of Greek armor that characterizes the other part of the story, it has one opening right here. And so consequently, that's exactly where David's supposed to aim at. That's exactly where the damage gets done. You get hit with a bullet or something else right here, and he falls over dead. And so the story makes a lot of practical sense, at which point David then takes Saul's sword, and unlike Saul, who's so ineffectual, he uses it to actually affect change by cutting off the head of the enemy. So you get all this. And you also get the sense that throughout this battle, David is relying upon the God of Israel for help. I preached on this thing about 3 or 4 years ago. It's long enough that I forgot what I preached about, and I had to go do all the research again. But one of the things that I preached about 4 years ago was how the attitude of this battle was precisely what we need to get away from in Christianity. This is a very, as I said, testosterone-filled, macho display of violence and strength. And I'm not sure it's the kind of thing that we want to teach as the optimal way to do modern-day Christianity. This is a very male-dominated story with all the worst characteristics sometimes of that. Well, one thing I noticed as I read back through it this time was the appreciation I have for the fact that the story also tells us that those people who rely upon God in seemingly overwhelming situations against massive power and force, God can still be on their side. I can't go any further today without talking about what happened in Charleston, South Carolina on Wednesday at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church, when, as you know, young Dylan Roof walked into Bible study, stayed for a while, and then pulled out a revolver and killed 9 people. Making it clear, as he did the act, that this is a crime of race. This was a murder on the basis of skin color. I spent the last 3 days, like you maybe, listening and reading and watching. And I've heard various Republican candidates, presidential candidates, who have told us his crime was not motivated by race, but instead represented somehow an attack on the church. Like one guesses, so many of them feel about religious freedom, so-called religious freedom laws that are passed. You've got people like Lindsey Graham, who said
there are real people who are organized out there to kill people in religion based on race. This guy's just whacked out. But it's 2015. There are people out there looking for Christians to kill. And that, for him, is what this was about. Or, other people said, this is simply senseless violence. One person. They moved on, like the Wall Street Journal, which had an opinion piece this time, that this week, that said, what causes young men such as Dylan Roof to erupt in homicidal rage, whatever their motivation, is a problem that defies explanation beyond the reality that evil still stalks humanity. It is no small solace that in committing such an act, he stands alone. Or, people are asked about the Confederate flag that flies from the front of the State House in South Carolina, 2 hours away from this killing, who said this had no relationship whatsoever to what Dylan Roof did. In other words, there's a narrative that's out there that race has nothing to do with what happened in South Carolina. Because if it did, then where do people have to go next? Affirmative action back in place, if you admit there's a race problem still in America. School lunch funding increased. If there's no more race problem in America, then we can move on. And nothing has to change. I also read this week about this remarkable place, as maybe you now know, this church, its history, the fact that it goes back to the early 1800s. You read history, you can learn some stuff. I believe that. And I read, as you may have, about Denmark Vesey, the former slave who was arrested. He was one of the founders of this church and arrested in 1822 for supposedly planning a resurrection uprising of the slaves against the white folks in South Carolina. Historians are divided as to how elaborately this revolt was actually planned. But we do know that Vesey was upset because the state of South Carolina had decided that black churches could not be open anymore at night, nor could they have Bible study in them, because that would teach slaves how to read and how to think. And Vesey himself was very upset about these kind of regulations and laws. Now, the reason South Carolina was so interested in all of this was, other than Mississippi, it was one of the two and maybe three states in the country that had more slaves than white people. So they were in a constant state of paranoia about being overrun by slaves because the slaves had the numbers. Well, after Denmark Vesey was captured and hung and then shot along with others, a mob came the next year and burnt the church down to the ground. And his son was one of the people who built this church back up, the church where the shooting happened this week. A block away from the church, a military garrison was then built to control the population. That garrison became the foundation of the Citadel, the college that is there. You can watch him play sports in NCAA Division I. It's only a little 3 or 4 decades later that the Confederate flag is been put into place. It's designed by a man named William Thompson, a newspaper editor out of Georgia, who designed the flag and went on to say, as a people, we are fighting to maintain the heaven-ordained supremacy of the white man over the inferior or colored race. And that is what the flag meant to him and to so many others. And then in the year 2000, the state senate of South Carolina took the flag off the top of the state capitol, put a little bit different form of the flag out in front of the state house to, as they said, honor Confederate soldiers. But by this time, that flag doesn't mean that and didn't mean that, if it ever did. It has all these other meanings attached to it, even if nobody wants to talk about them. The flag, no doubt, meant to its supporters the values of white culture, which some of them felt was under attack. It meant the federal government that came down and fought slavery was too overarching in the 21st century. It kept trying to force, I know some of them felt, the states to accept a version of equality that they didn't want to accept. People down there would tell you it's the principle of the thing, but you know it's not that. You know, and we know it's about race. You cannot say it's still not about race. And here's the point. History doesn't die. It only goes underground when we don't talk about it. Dylann Roof is right, white, and 21. And we might hear from the Supreme Court that the race problem in America is over. But it is not. Even if we think it's over, some of us will look to millennials, younger generation, and say, well, they're going to change things. But that's not as simple as it sounds either. Last year, a survey of millennials found that, in fact, they are more diverse and tolerant than most Americans. 91% of them believe in equality. 89% say all people should be treated as equals. But if you dig a little deeper, you find out only 30% of whites who are millennials were raised in families that talked about race. 68% of those surveyed didn't think talking about race was a good idea. They agreed with the statement, focusing on race prevents society from being colorblind. 74% of white millennials believe affirmative action is unfair, regardless of historical inequalities. Either 48 or 58, depending on which poll percent of white millennials, believe that white discrimination is just as big a problem as black discrimination. And while 73% of millennials say we should talk more openly about race, only 20% of them said they're comfortable actually doing it. And I wonder how many churches are openly talking about race this morning. And by opening, I don't mean using the words that we often use in church about grace and forgiveness and hope, all important things, but without a context become vague and imprecise. I bet a lot of them are saying, yes, it was a tragedy what happened, and we should pray that people's attitudes can change. But I want churches to say that we're living in a country where racism still exists and where history rears its head over and over again. And until we stand here and say those kind of things, until we say that the people who say that there is no race problem in America are wrong, and those who oppose policies that don't want to extend voting rights to African Americans, who want to restrict those voting rights, those people who say that we should give less to the poor for school lunches, that we should cut aid to urban centers, that we have enough low-income housing already, that those people who say these kind of things stand in a long line of people who visit both open and silent terror upon parts of the population whose ancestors lived in slavery. It is time to have a direct talk about race using clear language, transparent language, and not do what churches and other people often do and hide their criticisms behind words like love and healing by never talking about the laws or the policies or the politics that would bring these things to actually bear. I struggled in the last few days trying to find, because I knew there was a link between Goliath and David and what happened in Charleston. And yesterday I read from the diary or the writings that they think they have discovered from Dylann Roof, where he said the following, "I had no choice. We have no skinheads, no real KKK, no one doing anything but talking on the internet. Well, someone has to have the bravery to take it out into the real world, and I guess that has to be me." And I had this vision of Dylann Roof hearing the story of David and Goliath and picturing himself as some kind of David armed with, instead of a slingshot, a handgun, and taking on some kind of what he sees as a giant Goliath. and believing that even one person can take down this evil and start perhaps a race war, which evidently is what he fantasized about. But if he ever felt that way, he got it all wrong. People, we in the church, reading passages like this, sometimes get it all wrong. We're not David. See, this is I had this realization I heard Dominic Crossan say one time, when Christians read the Bible, we think we're Jesus. We're Rome. And I think when we read the story, we think we're David. We don't think we're Goliath. But when you look at it, Goliath is the prototype. Goliath is the force that conquers. Goliath is the one who dominates, who fears the terrorist and the unexpected attack. Goliath is the one who has everything to lose at this upstart population that's oppressed, who is always having to prove himself so that the minority stays the minority and never gets a leg up over those who are dominant. That's who Goliath is. And perhaps if we talked about race in real and honest ways, Dylan Roof would have realized that he was holding in his hand a piece of Goliath. He was pointing it at a room full of Davids who didn't even have a slingshot. And perhaps if there were gun control in this country that were more sound, he wouldn't have had that revolver. Perhaps, perhaps not. I don't know. But it doesn't mean it's not part of the race problem. But I do know that not to talk about race, not to acknowledge the historical real effects of racism, is to say that we have eradicated the race problem in America is to be a Goliath. I think it's fair to say we don't live in a country that has the level of violence that Denmark Vesey witnessed. We don't live in a violent country like the KKK had in the 18th and early 1900s. Things have changed. To pretend that they haven't, as one writer put it, is to dishonor the millions of Americans who have worked, suffered, and in some way died, some cases died, to effect the change. But neither can we say we are home free or saved or that the redemption of the races is at hand. Not when we live in a place that doesn't even want to talk about it. This is the place, the one place where the story of David and Goliath rings true to me. If we fight, I believe, in concrete and real ways with laws and legislations and policies that empower rather than take power away, that lift up rather than destroy, that feed people rather than starve them, that give decent housing rather than no housing, if we fight that Goliath, we have to do it in the name of truth, or as we say in the church, in the name of God. The way David fought, with innovation and ingenuity, but without the bragging and the threats and the macho behavior. Some things are the same as they were. Some things have changed. I want to end today with a little bit of a piece. Maybe a couple of you have read it. It was on the Atlantic Online. Charlie Pierce wrote it. It, to me, was the best thing I read about this all week. Here's what he wrote. Some of what he wrote. What happened in a Charleston church on Wednesday night is a lot of things. But one thing it's not is unspeakable. We should speak of it often. We should speak of it loudly. We should speak of it as terrorism, which is what it was. We should speak of it as racial violence, which is what it was. We should speak of it as an attack on history, which it was. This was a church founded by Denmark Vesey, who planned a slave revolt in 1822. Vesey was convicted in a secret trial in which many of the witnesses testified after being tortured. After they hung him, a mob burned down the church he built. His sons rebuilt it. On Wednesday night, someone turned it into a slaughter pen. We should speak of it as an assault on the idea of a political commonwealth, which is what it was. We should speak of it as one more example of all these things, another link in a bloody chain of events that reaches all the way back to African wharves and southern docks. It is not an isolated incident. Not if you consider history as something alive that can live and breathe and bleed. We should speak of all these things. What happened in that church was a lot of things, but unspeakable is not one of them. So it's time for us to speak now, when the battle is in front of us, when the ground is still flowing with blood. I hope we can speak. Let us speak about how race still plays out in every bit of legislation that's passed, in every election we vote in every racist joke that is told, innocently or not. Let us speak about our unredeemed selves, the parts of us that still harbor unexamined prejudice, the parts of ourselves that still enjoy the privileges and the rewards that come with being part of Goliath, even if it means someone else is suffering as a result. Let us speak with judgment towards those who act like this event is not about race, who instead make it a story that fits their campaign narrative, instead of treating it like a real tragedy with loss and grief and tears that flow endlessly and it seems like will never be completely ceased. But most of all, let us continue here and everywhere else to talk about race, until the day we die. Amen.